Hello and welcome to Life Sciences in Queensland. Joining us today is biomedical engineer, inventor, scientist, entrepreneur and business builder Professor Mark Kendall. Professor Kendall is the founder and CEO of Wear Optimo, the company that recently announced it will soon begin manufacturing breakthrough micro-wearable medical technology in a $30 million project backed by the Australian National University and signed off by the Queensland Government. He is also the ANU Vice-Chancellor's Entrepreneurial Professor. Mark Kendall, welcome.
Thank you, Anthony.
What a significant announcement recently about the work that you and your team have been working on.
Oh, we're hugely excited by this. It's allowing us for the first time to produce our microwearables here in Australia. So pre-COVID, the fashion, I think, was to, when you get to a certain stage where you've got a factory, or when you're looking to set up a factory, you might do it offshore. But things have changed, and we've changed with that. So we're doing it here in Queensland, here in Brisbane, actually. And it's end-to-end production of a Queensland concept, the microwearable, something that we've invented here and we've patented, something that we've worked up to a proven prototype point. And now we have this roadmap in front of us that's funded to allow us to make something like about 26 million microwearables per year as packaged product, which, as luck would have it, turns out to be one for every man, woman and child in the country.
And a less painful way to deliver medicine such as vaccine. I can hear a lot of us cheering in the background. How do the micro wearables work?
So it's a micro wearable sensor. So I'm wearing an Apple Watch, and of course that's not great for an audio to talk about something we can see, because when we think about wearables, that's the kind of thing we think about. But it's really interesting. Apple Watches have only been around for about 5-6 years, yet they feel like they've been here forever. So when we think of wearables, we think of those sorts of devices, and they're really useful in many different ways. But from a medical point of view, you could say that they're toys. And one of the things that's holding them back is they use light that reaches into the skin, and they can read a few things with that light. Mm-hmm. But the skin is an amazing barrier. It's something that I've been studying and working with functional medical devices for more than 23 years. And if you can reach in physically, you can gain access to all manner of biomarkers that today's wearables like an Apple Watch cannot. And that's what the microwearable does. So it's a sticker-like device. Under a microscope, you see little tiny structures. Those structures reach into this outer layer called the viable epidermis. But let's be clear, we're talking about just reaching a hair's width into the skin, mm-hmm. right? And then gaining access to these key biomarkers that today's wearables cannot. And the examples include things like troponin. So troponin is a chemical that's released as someone's having a heart attack. It's a protein. Our microwearables, and we've been working on this, our cardiac microwearable is positioned to measure that. And that will buy you time, so give you an early readout that you're on the pathway to having a heart attack, to allow those critical interventions to take place. So that's just one example, and there's many others. We have a 10-year roadmap that we've worked up. A good way of looking at the microwearable is it's a technology platform. And then what comes with that is you need to choose where to go with it. So what's the right fit for that? And there's many different applications. So, and of course, if we had infinite resources, we'd chase them all down. But life's not like that. So you need to choose where you begin. So we're choosing to begin in the area of continuous monitoring of hydration. It's the simplest embodiment of the microwearable. It's a minimal viable product, if you will. And it addresses massive unmet needs. So I'll give you a couple of examples. So the first is the mining sector. Another is the military. And the third is aged care. So if we go back to the mining, so it turns out I completely underestimated the issue of hydration. Mm-hmm. So I came from it from the world of medical devices, where if you're working on a vaccine, that's a big deal. And but if you're dehydrated, what's the big deal? Just have a glass of water and get on with your life. It's not quite like that at all. In fact, it's nothing like that. In the mining setting, you're in an extreme environment. It's been proven now that if you're just, say, 1.5% dehydrated, so it's not a lot, it affects the way you think a lot. It affects your cognitive function. So much so, it's the equivalent of having a few alcoholic drinks. In fact, the equivalent of being over the alcoholic, limit for the breath test. Now, that's a big deal if you're driving a 300-ton coal hauler, right, as one example. And I'm not even talking about the cases of when you have when people are dying in those settings. I'm talking about these things that happen all the time. If I switch across to aged care, all of that, what I've just said, is true, except people aren't driving a coal hauler. But there's additional issues when someone is elderly. And this is intriguing. As you get older, as we get older, I should say, our ability to know that we need to have a drink of water gets weaker. So our senses...
I didn't know that.
Our senses sort of attenuate. So we lose the ability to know that we should be drinking water. That, coupled with many other issues associated with being elderly, is causing a big problem. We just had the Royal Commission come down for aged care, and the key recommendations there is better management of dehydration. In fact, so much so, 1 in 5 of the things that go wrong for people in aged care is directly attributed to poorly managed hydration.
And how long has it taken Wear Optimo to get to this particular point in the production?
Great question. One cheeky answer, I'd say, is 23 years. that's been my career in biomedical engineering, getting things done with the skin and the accumulated knowledge in that space. I think it's actually, that's the truthful answer. I would not have been able to position Wear Optimo the way I have without that base of knowledge that's been generated over those years with previous technologies, the science base of working with the skin, and all the rest. So it's been a long journey for a company that's only been around since the start of 2018, and with the backing of the Australian National University.
You are internationally recognised as a leading innovator who produces solutions to global health problems. Why have you chosen Queensland?
This is drawing a long bow, but I'll do it. So Steve Jobs. So Steve Jobs set up Apple at a place called Cupertino in California. Mm-hmm. Why did he do that? That's where he lived. That was the answer.
Yeah.
So I'm a Queenslander. So I care a lot about Queensland, and I like living here. I did take a journey where I went overseas and was at Oxford University for 8 years and loved all of that and everything that came with it. But I wanted to do it here. And I still do. So I care about what our future is here. I think that I want to be part of building a vibrant biotech ecosystem that's here.
Mark, you've personally achieved a lot in your career to date. How did you get started on the path that you're on now?
So for those of that are listening that are thinking about 5-year plans, you might want to tear it up now because here's the truth.
Is this a 10-year, 15-year plan we're talking?
So when I finished my PhD in rockets, so nearby at the University of Queensland, so Richard Morgan was my supervisor, and Professor Morgan, I should say. I love rockets, and the next step was to work on rockets in California at a place called Caltech, and there was a job lined up for me to do that. And that was a dream job. For those who don't know what Caltech is or JPL, think of the Big Bang Theory. That's in that setting. So that's a mecca for rockets, or one of them. There's another one in Russia.
And what do you love about rockets, though?
Oh, so I'm a child from... I think I was born the day Apollo 16 took off, right? So I was kind of... Okay, the Apollo missions had already happened by the time I had a memory, but I was fascinated by space travel and everything that can happen with that, and the concept of being an astronaut. And rockets are just amazing devices. They're the only thing that can scale. They're the only human-built engine of any sort that can scale 10 orders of magnitude in size. Mm. So what that means is the biggest ones are around 100 metres tall. And then you go down one order of magnitude, 10 meters, two order of magnitude, 1 meter, and down to micron-sized rockets. So I love rockets for many different reasons. But so that was the plan, and then it all went out the window with a two-minute conversation.
And what was that two-minute conversation?
I met a guy at a conference, and he saw me give a presentation. He came up to me, and he said, I really enjoyed your presentation. I have this idea to use rockets to fire vaccines into the skin. Microparticle vaccines, would you like to come and work with me? I thought, oh, that really sounds interesting. So I had two questions. So the first was, where is it? where is this taking place? And he said at Oxford University. And the second one was, would I get a chance to row? And he said, if you're good enough. And now there's a lot more to it than that. There was a formal process, but 3 months later, my wife and I had just been married, and we went across as 25-year-olds across to England, and we're at Oxford.
And Oxford really was it was pivotal to your career, to where you are today.
Absolutely. Yeah. So, and look, my PhD was pivotal. My undergraduate degree in mechanical engineering was pivotal. They all were. But Oxford really changed my life and the trajectory. And the reason why is I was there for 8 years, and I was a lecturer. And the formative years for me as a professional, I suppose. So I was I just happened to be at this place where there was a biotech company that spun out of the research group that I was in, and it became Oxford's most successful biotech company. And I happened to be working with the founder, the professor, and working closely with the CEO as well, and working closely with that company. So there's all those things you might expect when you think of a place like Oxford. Yes, I had the old teaching office. It was a 15th century office, and there was a butler called Terry, and he was wonderful. And yes, I did get a chance to row, and yes, the winters were cold and dark, and it rained a lot. All of that's true. Mm-hmm. But the big surprise package was this 8-year ongoing apprenticeship in innovation, where I learned how to patent ideas, how to build interdisciplinary teams, how to form high-performing teams where you can have excellence across the board, how to chase down the problem at hand that doesn't come neatly packaged within one particular field, how to be brave enough to step out from working on rockets into immunology and learn that, and also how to partner with companies. And of course, there was the last part to this, which was the company called Powderject, who was purchased by a vaccines company. So how that was done, now I wasn't at the tip of the spear of that, but was in and around it and was exposed to it. And to me, that just felt like that's what you do. It felt special at the time, and it was. It's only looking back at it with the benefit of hindsight that I realized it was super special. So that changed my life. And the people that I work with, I'm still in touch with and work with. And even the first PhD student that I supervised there, and at that time there wasn't much age difference between us, because we're talking about a period for his PhD, it was 1999 to 2001. So Peter is his name. So Peter has founded his own company over there in Oxfordshire. It's called Oxford Immunotech, and has been CEO of that, and that was sold just recently to a bigger company to go on to the next bigger things. But for about $1 billion. That's the kind of stuff that I was exposed to.
Mark, what sort of opportunities do you see opening up in the future in your field for those who may be just starting out on their own career path when you reflect on how far you've come and the stories you've told us?
Oh, I think the opportunities are huge.
Yeah.
But it's how you look at the opportunities and what you do with them. So I talked about the concept of an innovation apprenticeship. That's really something I care about a lot. It's something that the Oxford experience provided me. That's something that I'm passionate about providing others. The company that I've set up and founded and are running, called Corbware Optimo, its vision is three things. This answer is relevant, by the way. the vision, so this is not a corporate discussion, it's just giving you context. So the first is taking forward our micro wearables as rapidly as possible to make a difference in healthcare. The second is being a national asset. So what that means is if there's something that comes up that matters to the country or to the state where we think we can help, we do. But the third is this topic, it's providing innovation apprenticeships to the next generation. And the way to do it is learning by doing. So you can study innovation, that's fine. You can read about it, that's fine. And all of that's useful. Nothing beats getting in there and being exposed and working with amazing people and just the immersion of it. And I think about the team that we already have at We're Optimo. We have amazing scientists, people with PhDs from Oxford, Cambridge, Stanford, Boston University, and also fine Australian universities, right? So it's probably the best team I've ever led. And there's a lot of young talent. And our model is that we're exposing them to all of this, an open model. So the idea is that they learn it, like I did, and just maybe 10, 15 years from now, a good handful of those, perhaps more, are doing this kind of thing in their own right. Mm. And maybe a good slice of that's taking place here. And that's, I think, a key way we can grow our ecosystem.
Science in a laboratory is one thing. Getting it out into the community, or some would call it commercializing something that's being discovered, is another. Is it getting easier, do you think, for science to then move it into mainstream?
It's always hard. Mm. But that's typically the best stuff is. So science is hard.
Yeah.
Science is hard in its own right, and it's interesting, the more you learn about science, the more you develop a healthy respect for how much you don't know and how much we don't know as humanity. So taking it the one step further, yeah, it's not easy because it feels different, but it's interesting at the human level. I think at the simplest level, it's very similar. And so it's a communication thing. In the end, if you're doing science, if you're commercializing, if you're talking to an investor, if you're communicating outwards, whatever it is, right? In the end, or if you're teaching a tutorial, in the end, it's a dynamic communication exercise where you're learning in the interaction where someone is on a particular journey, like how much they know on a particular topic, and you're taking them forward from there. And also you're being taken forward from the other side of the table. So it's hard, but if you strip it down at its fundamental building block, I think that's a key ingredient.
Has COVID made it easier for science, given that it seems to be on the front page every day?
There's many ways to answer that question. Life's become very unpredictable, the pre-pandemic versus where we are now. There's so many things that have played out that we couldn't even have imagined. If we take a look at the vaccine narrative, producing the vaccines that the vaccines field has done at that speed and as well as they have is a minor miracle. So doing that within less than a year, that's a brilliant achievement. I think the way we look at science has changed. I think and certainly health tech. If we get into health, that's changed in a massive way. There's the push towards telemedicine. Let me put it a different way. I think health tech has been given a big kick up the backside.
Mm.
So things have been accelerated in ways that were bubbling along, but then there's been a big jump forward. So we're talking about telemedicine's changed, the need for how that's done. Personalised medicine has changed. So there's so many accelerants that have taken place. The way people look at health tech is not a side boutique thing, perhaps. I'm talking about international markets now. People are less interested in investing in, say, mining or investing in real estate. They see actually fundamental to who we are and how we live is in medicines and healthcare. So I'd like to invest into that so we don't get to perhaps experience the kind of thing that we've experienced the last 12 months.
Mm. And for micro wearables, where to from here? What's next?
So we see ourselves as part of that narrative of changing how medicine has been done. Traditionally, medicine is a one-size-fits-all process. So if you're trying to produce a drug, you test it on a large population of people, you get an average out of that, do a bit of analysis, and you'd arrive at a dose, a one-size-fits-all dose. It's not like that for a lot of things. So each of us has our own set points, and if you can discover that set point, it's like that communication thing I was telling you before. It's kind of a communication in medicine. So where we come in is that we're part of that communication. We're actually listening to the body, right, and finding out where it's at on a particular thing so the right medicine, the right place, and the right time can come in. And I think that's a big part of how things are changing. And the other thing I would say about healthcare in general, I think most people would not realize just how big healthcare is as a global activity or a market. So it's the biggest market on the planet.
Mm-hmm.
So to give you context on this, the size of all global domestic products rolled up for all economies pre-COVID was about $100 trillion per year. healthcare is $10 trillion per year. It's the biggest by a long way. So it is significant. And there's a real push to do that better. There's many ways to look at that. There's so many deaths that are taking place that obviously need to be addressed. But then there's, in addition to that, inefficiencies. It's traditionally hospital-centric, and the costs of how that gets done just pile up and pile up and pile up. Imagine if you bring it to your home. Imagine if you do have these sorts of sensors that give you an early read on something to allow a kind of preemptive strike before things become very problematic. So anyway, that's a long answer to a short question.
Well, thank you so much, Professor Mark Kendall, for spending time today speaking about some of the exciting advances in medical technology being realised right here in Queensland.
Thank you.